doing, Dan?
Hello, Matthew.
You start this week, Dan.
Here we are again.
Here we are again.
In Studio P.
Studio P.
Studio Podcast.
Studio Podcast.
Do you know, we've done, this would be episode 15 of the reboot.
We've like doubled the amount of podcasts that we've done.
That actually is, because I think you did a run of about 14.
A limited series, we will say.
Of the, original series. It's like the original Star Trek.
Yes.
And this is podcast The Next Generation.
Okay. That's niche, Dan.
This is...
I've no idea what you're talking about.
Is it? Who hasn't? Everyone knows what's... Anyway. Welcome to the podcast. Here we are.
Fellow Trekkers, welcome.
Hello, Trekkies. We'll be covering the music of Star Trek this year.
This year,
throughout the rest of the series, we'll be covering the music of Star Trek. Matt, you've been away again.
I know. I was in another posh studio.
Another.
Which I want to start talking about, actually.
Yeah,
because,
let's do it.
I was in Livingston.
Yeah.
Which, for those of you who don't know, is in North London. Used to be a church. Been there since the 80s, I think.
Uh-huh.
And it's sort of quite a legendary, like, jazz recording place.
It's sort of one of the, what I kind of call the old guard of studios, isn't it? The ones that, there's a certain characteristic to studios that were built in the 80s, which is that it almost seemed like there was an unlimited amount of money.
Yeah, and daylight was, it seemed to be the enemy.
Yes.
We don't want any daylight.
Which is weird. I mean, I was just showing some people around the studio, like, and I was thinking about when we built this place, the cost of blocking out a window is probably more than just adding more glass to it. So it's weird that... Anyway, that's an aside. Please continue.
Basically, the upshot is we need to get a 47 and a 67.
Oh, yeah, okay.
There we go.
If anyone wants to donate any microphones...
So it was quite interesting. I did... 2 days there of drums,
uh-huh.
One in Studio B and one in the main room in Studio A.
Okay, so it's two different rooms.
For which, and I will give you details about what I was doing there in the coming weeks.
Mm.
But the day one, I was in the kind of boothy room, dry room.
Yeah.
And there was a 47. Actually, you know, one of the Telefunken 47 reissues.
Okay, so a new one.
Yeah, I think they've about 15 years old.
Oh, okay, so not the.
And it sounded glorious. And mm-hmm. then on the day two, it was mono overhead, the 67.
Yeah,
sounded great.
Yeah,
I mean there is a reason why those people like those mics.
Yes. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah.
Because I mean, here's the question, Dan.
Mm.
Like, are those so? 67, what? Anywhere between 10 and 15 grand.
Yeah. I think a new one's about six, isn't it? A brand new
retail. Yeah, which I haven't tried. I haven't tried.
Yeah.
Worth the money? Question mark?
So I think it's really a question of what you're doing. So people know...
I was thinking about getting them for the podcast, Dan.
Yeah, exactly. Well... We should really be upgrading the podcast to 67. Yeah.
Do we need two?
Yeah, exactly.
Or we could just have one on figure of eight and go either side.
Yeah. I mean, it's almost a bit of a kind of a cliche of the sort of the music production media world to say that it's not really about the gear. But it is, obviously, as we know. But when people say it's not about the gear, like, as we know, the ideas and the performance and everything are the most important thing.
If I can unpack what you're saying here, Dan, if you don't mind.
Yeah.
I think the point is that a 67 isn't going to make you sing any better.
Exactly.
It's not going to make...
In fact, I would go as far as to say it will capture your... subpar performance in more detail,
thus making it sound even more subpar.
Yes,
interesting.
In some senses, yes.
So it's not.
Once you bang it through auto tune, I mean, you know.
But it's not going to make. It's not going to make. Yeah, it's not going to make your production, your song, your performance sound any better.
Exactly. Yeah.
However.
Yeah, we are really as producers and recording engineers, we are, you know. in we play a supporting role to those things, but our responsibility isn't to, well, you as a session drummer, as obviously you're being a musician, in you're in the musician role there, but when it comes to choice of microphone, you're, it's an engineering question really.
Yeah.
And really that's all our responsibility is to make sure the artist is comfortable and then capture whatever they're doing in the best way.
Yeah. So if you imagine that the singer's really good, the song's really good, yeah, everything's good.
Yeah, yeah, all things being equal.
I would say that the 67...
I think the 67 is money. Probably more versatile, yeah, than a 47.
I guess the question is it, are those big price tag... are those big price tag microphones worth it, is the question.
Well, I would say probably the 15 grand 1960 something U67 or U47, the really, really old one,
yeah,
is probably not worth it.
No.
Except for, you know, like, except for in the sense of like, you know, some people like to own an expensive car for the sake of it,
mm-hmm,
you know, and if you're, and if you want to drive a sort of Mercedes for the sake of it, so you can show off to people, then maybe the 15 grand is worth it.
I don't think it's about showing off. I mean, I don't know if I talked about this on the podcast, but I mixed something last year,
mm-hmm,
that was recorded on a 67.
Mm.
And when I got the Pro Tools session,
yeah,
I just, the vocal just sounded astonishingly good. Okay, yeah, good, yeah, singer, good song, blah, blah, blah. Yeah. All that was taken care, yeah, of. But like, and as I started to compress it, all, nothing but goodness came back at me.
Absolutely, yeah.
And you're just like, yeah, shit. So I called the engineer and I was like, yeah, dude, what is your vocal chain? Mm. And it was a 67.
Yeah.
So I would actually say,
mm,
I don't know, like say I just had, I don't know, 100K, not even that, 50 grand to spend on gear. I got a massive publishing deal or something.
Yeah.
I'd buy that 67.
The vintage one.
For 15, yeah. It's right. I think it's worth, because it's the best sounding vocal I've ever worked
with. It's hard to know whether, I feel like I've heard people say that the new one is...
Yeah, I would try the new one is, first, actually.
Yeah, because it's going to have a warranty.
Yeah, no, I'm not necessarily saying, oh, it's got to be the vintage one, man.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's sort of it depends if it's all a question of like, is it going to make a difference? The thing about vintage gear is it can be quite variable, particularly with the 47s.
It can totally be variable.
Some of the 47s are big money,
yeah,
and sound like crap because they're just, yeah, knackered and not well looked after.
I totally agree, Dan. And just, I guess because I know probably the most about drums.
Oh.
I mean, there's a lot of vintage drum gear that's just horrendous.
Yeah.
That people think they're going, oh, I've got this vintage whatever.
Mm-hmm.
You hear it and it's just like, oh, this is awful.
Yes.
This has just had 50 years of abuse.
Not your kit, though.
My kit's great.
Yeah.
But sometimes they're just trauma victims.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't get especially romantic about equipment personally. But you know, there is some value in, if it excites the artist,
yep,
to be recording through a vintage mic or playing a vintage guitar, I think that's important and that's valid. And I think, like, you know, when it comes to like preamps and stuff, and you know, and I think preamps are a little bit more hardy. You know, I think an old...
What do you mean hardy? Oh, you mean they're not as susceptible to
getting knackered? You know, as long as they're kind of had a little service and maybe a recap or whatever. Mm. But I think the romance value of it is valid if that becomes part of what you're doing, part of the process, if you see what I mean. But I mean, I would really like to, I'd love to have a, it's been a long time since I've done a mic shootout with equipment that I'm not already familiar with, you know, like I tend to, you know, unless the first mic that you put up is sounding just amazing.
Yeah.
I do try, and as long as there's time.
Well, you put up a couple of, do you do that thing where you put up like two mics with a pop shield?
Over both of them.
No, I'm a little suspicious of that, actually. I just like.
Why are you suspicious of that? You only have to. You don't have to cheat. You don't have to take both of them.
Well, you're kind of. You're not singing directly into either one. It's not. It's not completely representative of how you actually.
How you sing.
Yeah.
No, that's so interesting.
I'd rather put the two mics up next to each other, plumb them both in through the same chain, you know.
Yeah.
And then just have the singer do a verse and a chorus in both of them. And then have the two, maybe three mics, and then have them come in. And then you play them back in a random order so they don't know. Obviously it's hard. You as the engineer, it's hard to know which is which.
Would you do that every time with a new singer, Dan?
I think because I know our mic selection so well, I tend to know what.
I would say the same for me.
Yeah.
Like, I'm usually right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, if the singer's like, I don't know, you've got quite a high, bright voice. I'm just not going to use your A7.
Yeah, because you'll kind of multiply what's already there.
Yeah.
Except anywhere and use any of the Aston Spirits, which are even a bit more toppy.
I think my recently my favorite vocal mic that's been the best on the most amount of vocals is the RE20 with a cloud lifter.
Okay, yeah.
That seems to be
Yeah, have you used the RE20 lately, actually?
So good.
Yeah, it is. It's good enough for Tom York.
You don't know that Tom York uses it in the studio. Oh, do you know that?
I think I do, yeah. Well, it's certainly in those From the Basement sessions.
Yeah, true.
Dan put that in the show notes, which is From the Basement sessions was like when I think it was like a couple of months after they released In Rainbows, there was a kind of a live session version of it. And he's using a RE20 in those.
Yeah.
And it sounds very much like the record, you know. It's like,
but that's because it's the same singer, Dan.
Yeah. But if that's not the mic that's used on the record, then it would be doing a good job anyway. It's a good fit for his voice. And that is the fucking point, is it's the most important thing is the mic's gotta fit with the singer. And like, yeah, there isn't, I don't know. I don't know how often you get asked this, but I get asked.
What do you get
every
asked?
So often? What's the best mic for vocals?
Yeah, that's such a such a weird question, isn't it? But that's like saying, I get asked, yeah, what's the best snare drum or something like that, and you're just. Oh,
and you know what? God. You know, it's a bit like asking, what's the best color to paint my walls?
Yeah,
and it's like, well,
what's the best ingredient for cooking?
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah, but the walls analogy is quite. I mean, like if you paint your walls white, okay, you will probably get a reasonable result. You'll probably be reasonably happy.
Yeah.
So in which case, so, you know, as much as we kind of like to shit on the U87, it's like, it's not bad.
Do we shit on the U87?
Not as much as some people do.
Some people really shit on the U87.
Yeah. It will get you, unless it happens to be a real clash with the singer, a U87 generally will get you a good vocal result, you know. It doesn't mean that it's going to be better than some other mics that we've got, like SM7s, like that we're using now, or Audio Technica 80-4033.
Great mic.
That's the one I recommend most of the time. If someone's like, "What's a good general purpose mic?" I said, "I'm going to stake this, plant my flag, and say, in terms of a mic that you can." Get so I think they retail like £350 or something, but you can get them on eBay. I've seen them as low as £120 on eBay.
It's good, isn't it?
Because people get them and then they quote unquote upgrade to like a C414 or something, or a Neumann.
I would say
TLM103 or something.
If there was a fire, right, or say I could only grab one condenser between a 414 and the Audio Technica, I'd go for the Audio Technica.
Yeah. Yeah.
Only problem is it only cardioid. That's the only thing.
Yeah. But that's a good general purpose
that's great.
Thing. You know,
yeah.
If you've only got one mic anyway, it being cardioid is fine.
Whereas against the 414s, you've got five different polar pans, which is really handy.
Yeah, if it's a pair, obviously, if you've managed to save a pair of mics from a fire, maybe the 414s are a bit more useful because you've got You can set them up in all sorts of fun and elaborate ways.
Yeah.
As I did the last week, I did a little choir session last week.
Talk us through it, Dan. What was your mic set up?
So I had originally set up, I think it was the 414s.
How big was the choir?
Four. So four okay. singers.
Okay.
Who I think, I'm not sure they all knew each other.
Right.
But, or like, you know, it wasn't, or rather no, I think they knew each other, but they didn't, I don't think they sang together as wasn't a group that kind of regularly performs together. Might know each other maybe from church or something. Because I've got to say, churches produce some amazing singers.
Yeah, totally.
But I'm just speculating there. But they were fucking good.
Really?
So
were they kind of layering up?
Not
to produce a bigger. So there's only four of them. I mean,
not really.
It's
no.
four a choir. Okay, two singers isn't a choir.
A vocal ensemble.
Three probably isn't a choir. Is four a choir? What number of people?
What number of... That's this week's question. Email, podcast, urgentstudios.co.uk.
I would say four is an ensemble. Choir, it's got to be more than eight, I reckon, for a choir.
Okay, so that's an ensemble. But four people's ample for a band.
Yeah, but...
Two people's ample for a band.
But we're talking about choirs, not bands. Mm.
I think we might need to get a dictionary out.
Whatever.
Anyway.
How'd your mic come up, Dan?
Had a pair of, yeah, I think it was either the 414s, maybe just the Astons, actually. Astons. I say just the Astons.
Just the Astons.
And I started them on top of each other for in a Blumlein arrangement, which is figure of eight. And then the most important, spot mics on in the individual voices. I think I used the KSM-141s for the ladies and 414s for the gents, I think. I think that was the vibe.
Crazy.
Crazy, yeah. But the most important thing is, give it a listen before you start going, like, is this right, you know?
Are you telling that to yourself?
I'm telling that to yourself. No, because but it's always important to just consider, right, is this right? And then talking to Paolo Patton's, I switched it then to cardioid, and that the pair that was in the room.
Was it too roomy?
It was just the problem with Blumlein, right, is it's so directional that you can kind of at a distance there's a sweet spot. If you're too close to the source, it's insanely stereo.
Yes.
But if you've got a kind of a U sort of horse shape, U shape of singers, you can sort of find it. It will kind of just point. It has a little bit of a dead spot in it sometimes.
Can we talk about stereo?
I have
a problem with things that are aggressively stereo. Let me explain. Right. So there's a drum kit recorded.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you have the hi-hats just... like totally like hard right and then the floor tom is just over in the next field on the left.
Yeah.
I just that's not how a drum kit is. It's not this sort of super wide thing.
Gotcha. Yeah.
Pianos are the same.
Yeah.
Aggressively stereo.
Yeah.
And the thing I really don't understand as well is that people acoustic guitars recorded in stereo. I do not understand that.
Yeah, I'm not really...
I don't get it.
I'm not really a fan of that.
Because I did try it, you know, when you sort of put... Say you've got two condensers and you've got one down one end and one down the other end of an acoustic guitar.
Mm.
It just always sounds phasey and weird to me.
Yeah.
Whenever I've done it, I was just like, this is not how acoustic should sound. And even if you've got, like, say, a Blumlein or something,
yeah, well,
it's little bit stereo. I'm just like, man.
No, but a Blumlein would be, you're probably XY.
Sorry. I just don't hear a guitar being, an acoustic guitar being a stereo thing.
Yeah. I'm going to disagree with you
Fuck
a little
you,
bit there.
Fuck you, Dan.
But often, you know, I think the one that I find if I'm stereo miking it,
yeah,
and like that's, you know, that's part of the spec. That's my water.
Sorry, I thought it was
my... steal my water. How dare you?
I got a thirst on after that rant.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, maybe like an MS or something. Do you remember MS? Probably haven't done it in...
I haven't done an MS for
ages. Yeah, it's the one where you got a cardioid in the centre and a figure of eight.
I know, mate. Don't patronise me. Yeah, I know what MS
for the
is.
Listeners, mate. Oh, okay. For the listeners,
okay,
yeah.
I thought you talked to me.
Yeah. You know what it is.
I once did a drum session where the guy... It was in New York, actually. The only ever session I've done in New York.
Yeah.
And the engineer MS'd my overhead. And
right.
It sounded absolutely brilliant. I was just like, this is it. This is the way every overhead should be now. Because
okay.
You've got the mono option as well, obviously,
right.
There.
Yeah.
Tried it, couldn't get it to work.
Okay.
Tried it quite a few times. This guy just like really got, it was really cool.
Interesting. It's probably something that just happens to work in that particular room.
That's what I thought. It was quite a boofy scenario.
Yeah.
But I've tried.
When the fuck were you recording in New York?
I did when I was playing with Tom O'Dell.
Okay.
We were
That wasn't the time you went to New York for the day, was it?
No, I went to New York for the day. Yeah, it was great. I toured with Tom O'Dell for a year, 2013 going into 2014.
Mm.
And it was
kind of a world tour arrangement, wasn't it? I didn't see you much that year.
No, it was, I was away a lot. But we did two support shows with Billy Joel at Madison Square Gardens.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Yeah, which was like...
Fair play.
Well, it was just, I mean, support tours, particularly for an artist like that,
mm-hmm.
you're sort of playing to... Because when you say to people, I've played Madison Square Gardens, I have, but we played to people eating popcorn and finding their seats.
Unseated, is it?
Generally not giving a fuck. So, you know, it's not, you don't really have the attention of
yeah, is the support the slot a seated gig? I feel like maybe the support slot must be, must feel more, a bit more awkward.
I mean, to be honest, having done a lot of support shows over the years, you are faced with indifference a lot of the time.
What? I just remembered. Do you remember when Leander Havas played the Royal Albert Hall?
Yeah.
And as a support act,
was Josh Weller doing
she
it?
She booked the Kennets.
Oh, the Kennets,
which was moderately successful comedian Josh Weller.
He's more than moderately successful.
Yeah, I know, but this part of his shtick that you take the piss out of him.
Okay,
we love you, Josh.
We love you, Josh.
We love you so much. He had this very very noisy sort of three chord punk band. Who were actually. I was actually quite good. But just remember this, like, you know, very, obviously, Royal Albert Hall, in terms of formal settings,
it
doesn't get much more formal than that. Leanne is obviously, you know, she's not a big rock artist and she has probably quite a... Anyway, just remember, it's like, the front row of the gig just being the sort...
What the fuck is this?
Well, it was just sort of all people in their, like, 60s in like a suit and tie and kind of like, oh, we're going to the Albert Hall, and they just sat there politely watching this.
Yeah.
Very.
I don't remember. I remember going to that show, but I don't remember seeing the Kenneths. Sorry, Josh, if I missed.
Well, you should have been. You're just not as big a fan of the Kenneths as me.
Prefer their earlier work.
Yeah, exactly. I think it was all earlier work.
Okay. But anyway, what are we talking about, Dan?
You're talking about Billy Joel's support slot.
Anyway, whatever.
Oh, yeah. So why were you recording in New York? That was the plan, wasn't it?
Tom was demoing for his next record.
Okay, yeah.
Because he has an insane work ethic. And they were like 3 days off.
Yeah.
He was like, right, we're going to the studio.
Yeah.
And those recordings never saw
the light. No Empire State Building for you.
Do you know what? I did go up. No, okay. I went. I did go up the Empire State Building on that trip, but it must have been
no Statue of Liberty for you.
I didn't go to the Statue.
I was going to say no Alcatraz, but that's San Francisco.
That is.
Yeah. I was thinking.
But anyway, so yeah. Not MS. What is it? MS. We were talking about
MS. As an overhead. Yeah. I've got to say, I think I've struggled to get it to work as well. But yeah, on acoustic guitar, to be honest, I normally just find just get one decent mic.
Exactly.
In a good spot.
Exactly.
And if you really need some stereo characteristic...
Put some chorus on it.
Put some... Well, yeah, whack some chorus on it. Well, put some just nice bit of stereo reverb on it, which is sort of what you get from an MS anyway. The sides are kind of largely room tone anyway.
Yes. I'd agree with that.
You know what I mean? And then I guess the problem with MS is obviously it's very mono compatible, as we know. Because the two sides cancel each other out. The problem with that is the two sides cancel each other out and your room characteristic disappears in mono entirely. So it's not, it doesn't, yes, it's mono compatible, but you actually, something disappears.
Yeah. I remember the first time I did MS at the old Urchin and I thought I was so clever.
Yeah.
I thought, someone give me an engineering award now.
It is a little...
Look at this.
It is a little bit of...
I'm so clever.
It is a bit of a showy technique, isn't it? It is a bit fancy pants, you know. But sometimes it's the right thing.
Sometimes it's good to be fancy pants, Dan.
Yeah. But it's like in the hierarchy of what's important, it's, you know, I've just talked about great song, great performance, good instrument. Then we come down to equipment, you know, for capturing it. And then... Below that in the hierarchy is your fancy pants showy fucking techniques.
I don't think I've ever done anything. I was about to say, I don't think I've ever done anything complicated. No, I can't remember a time that where I don't know.
You're a simple man.
Like another one I can think of is that people talk about that Tony Visconti gating technique. Have you tried that for vocals? So you go in a room. And you've got three mics.
Mm-hmm.
So one right up close,
yeah.
And one like 3 foot away, and then one like 6 foot away.
Yeah, okay.
And you've got gates on them.
Yeah.
So as the singer gets louder, the gates open up, and it's supposed to add this sort of...
Okay, yeah.
I remember trying that.
Yeah, I'm just processing that.
It was shit. I probably didn't do it right.
I feel like that is possibly one of those things, if you're in Hansa Studios in 1970/80 something, there's a place for it. I think nowadays, with the fact that we can set up 27 different delays in our DAW, whether a technique like that is slightly redundant, you know. Mm. It's obviously, I'm sure if you're Tony Visconti, I'm sure it still works incredibly well.
Yeah.
But you know, it's extra setup where it's the performance is the key thing. If you're keeping the singer waiting for 20 minutes while you set up extra mics, then potentially you're losing more than what you gain in having fancy mics, you know.
I totally agree with you, Dan. How much time do we have left?
I don't know. One minute and 35 seconds.
Plug-in of the week, Dan. It's been a very geeky podcast this week.
We dug into the technicalities a little bit.
We did. Sorry, everyone.
Plugin of the week. I don't think I've deployed anything fancy pants in the past week, to be honest. I've done a mix for someone.
How did that go?
Oh, actually,
it was kind of poppy mix.
I'm gonna.
What are you gonna do?
This is almost like, okay, so the RC Retro 20 color thing.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah, it's a great plugin. This is, unfortunately, this is kind of part of the moan zone segment. You know, when you open it, the vinyl sound is always on.
I know.
Fuck that.
Yeah.
Fuck that.
Do you know, I'm going to add, I mean, I love sound toys, but radiator should not default to the noisy setting.
Well, that's a bit different.
No, it's not. Shut up. No, it's...
Do you know, but do you know what?
Why is that different? It's exactly the same principle.
It's mimicking vintage gear.
Yeah, but I go further to say that any gear... should just default to the noise being off.
Yeah, fair enough. Actually, the do you remember the you probably don't use the Massey plugins that much anymore, do you?
I do, actually, Dan. Do you? I used the De-Esser. Very big fan of that De-Esser.
That is plugin. That's my plugin of the week every fucking week. That is
the Massey De-Esser.
That is the best.
It's the best De-Esser.
Yeah.
Great on hi hats.
It's great on anything.
Oh, do you know what I used it for the other day as well? I had
We're getting excited here about the De-Essers.
acoustic guitar player, you know, there was a bit of fret.
It
totally sorted that out.
Yeah.
Oh, there it is.
But what I was going to say about the oh yeah
RC20 even, well RC20?
Even the Massey delay, this is Pro Tools only, guys, I'm so sorry, more Pro Tools only, we're gatekeeping the industry. But even the latest release of the delay actually has the hiss turned off.
Yeah, of course it does. But no one wants it.
The biggest problem with the RC20, right, is that it's trying to be helpful in that when the transport's not running, the hiss goes away. Have you noticed that?
Yes.
That's, again, it's sort of supposed to be helpful. But unfortunately, what happened the other week is that I was doing a mix and I'd got the stems. The multi-tracks, so I'm misusing the terms.
Dad.
Well, they were kind of worse stems, actually. But anyway, producer had an RC20 on something, and because it doesn't just sit there hissing the whole time or crackling, he managed to bake in that vinyl crackle to 50 different multi-tracks. Because it's just every time it was bouncing, the vinyl crackle was like,
so annoying.
Oh, the transport's running, I better do my vinyl crackle. So really I just annoying. Like brought up the stems. It was just an absolute bombardment.
Did he have to bounce it out
he
again?
Didn't have to
that's so then. Annoying.
Yeah, it was, and yeah, I think we've all been there though. Let's
have
be
I been
honest.
There? Probably.
The shit that I always find really is so easy to catch you out is with Melodyne when it's running as a plugin. You do some tuning or something. Anyone gets their vocals tuned, obviously, you know, everyone sings perfectly here. But in the unlikely event of having to tune something, and then for whatever reason, you make a cut to the arrangement move some stuff
that's
around.
That's it, yeah.
And then that,
so annoying.
That piece of audio is stuck out, isolated in the middle of the end of the song or something.
I think we should bring this Moan Zone back every week. I'm really into it.
I like the Moan Zone.
Yeah.
But it's, you could almost do it. Some podcasts have Hero of the Week and Villain of the Week.
I
think Hero of the Week is the Massey De-esser.
Yeah.
And Villain of the Week is the RC Retro Color 20 thing for having
but
that
only
vinyl.
For that feature. Oh, otherwise, it's a great plugin.
It's a great plugin. Yeah.
We love you. Okay.
Amen.
Have a great week, everyone.
Yeah. Join us next week. We'll be chatting more shit. I was going to say, there's never anything to announce. This is all, it's all off the cuff. Would you believe it? We just sit down and start talking without any planning. Can't believe it.
All right, bye everyone.
Bye-bye.
Bye.